This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes or Google Play or wherever you want. And when you're there, rate and review us and let us know how we're doing. Today, I am talking with Deborah Mashek. She is the executive director of Heterodox Academy, which is a group of academics and intellectuals who are trying to get this, improve the marketplace of ideas. Deb, thanks for talking to us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Why don't you start off by talking about the origins and the mission of Heterodox Academy?
The mission of Heterodox Academy, we'll start there, is to increase the quality of both research and education in higher ed. And we seek to do this by increasing viewpoint diversity, mutual understanding, and constructive disagreement. And as you mentioned, we're a nonpartisan nonprofit, and we right now have about 2,000 members who are professors as well as graduate students, all of whom have said, yeah, something weird is going on here in the academy, and we're really, you know, wanting to advocate for the inclusion of more perspectives in the classroom and on campuses. And you had asked about the origin story, and it really goes back to late 2015. So Jonathan Haidt, Nick Rosenkrantz, and Nick Martin, they got together and said, hey, in law and in social psych and in sociology, we're noticing that there's more of an orthodoxy than there used to be in terms of what ideas are allowed, what questions we can ask and answer, and so on. So the three of them decided to start this blog at heterodoxacademy.org. That's all it was at the beginning. This blog with kind of this cool sounding name, referencing, you know, Greek origins and the academy and whatnot. And they were just, it was a place where people could, you know, come together and write and think and try to diagnose the problem and whatnot. Shortly after they put up the blog, I think it was something like 4 days. It was really shortly after one of the blowups around Halloween costumes and whatnot, and saying that, is it okay to tell students what costumes they could or couldn't wear, that sort of thing. And all of a sudden, tons of academics were drawn over to the site and wanted to be a part of it. So over the past couple of years, it's become a more formal organization. We now have, you know, we're in a WeWork space, and they just hired me back in early February to be their first executive director. So now it's more of a formal organization. It's a membership organization. People are welcome to obviously come to our website, read the blog, all that good stuff.
And you have a podcast as well, the Heterodox Half Hour.
Yeah, the Half Hour of Heterodoxy. So
this is the exact opposite of the 2 minute hate, right? This is much longer and much nicer, I guess.
Yeah, and more organized toward constructive disagreement.
So let me ask, the people starting at Jonathan Haidt is probably the best known or to a Reason audience. He's a social psychologist. You mentioned there was a sociologist. And what was the other discipline that was involved at the very beginning?
Yeah, a law professor, Nick Rosenkrantz.
Oh, okay. So are those fields the ones that are... are they the ones that are kind of most homogeneous in their ideas? Or I have a background in literary studies. I know that literary studies has been closed, at least I wouldn't say closed, but it's been very close to monolithic in its kind of viewpoint or politics. Maybe not in the way it does stuff, but in its kind of political pronouncements. At least since the late 80s when I started in there, I know there are economics departments probably are pretty homogeneous too, although they tend to be more probably free market oriented, because even among kind of liberal economists, it seems like there's a strong consensus that. Markets are really good at producing stuff and kind of spreading it around. You might disagree about tinkering and whatnot, but are there particular fields that are less heterodox or more heterodox, or is this something that is really affecting the entire academy?
Well, I'm trying to think of what data I know of that are really discipline by discipline specific, and I'm having a hard time conjuring those in my mind. So let me share an anecdote that perhaps speaks to this, at least in social psych, which is also my background. At one point, actually, when I first had any intuition or understanding about how that this problem existed or how broad it was, I was at the Society for Psychological, no, it was SPSB, I forget our acronym. It's a big social psych conference. And Jonathan Haidt was the keynote speaker. And so we're in this vast, you know how they do at the conferences, they're like this big auditorium. They've, you know, folded back the accordion wall, so there's seats for everyone. And he had us stand up if we identified as liberal or progressive, and, you know, lots and lots of us stood up. Stand up if you identify as moderate, and there are a couple people who stood up. And stand up if you identify as right or conservative, and there's like one person who stood up in this hall that held hundreds. And it was this moment of just, it's really hard to deny the data at that point, at least for this one discipline, yeah, in this one space, albeit a space that attracts, you know, lots and lots of social psychologists. There was the Duarte paper, and I'm trying to remember what other disciplines they had in there other than social psychology. But what we hear is that certainly in the social sciences, this is a problem. And as you're mentioning, in a lot of more humanist oriented disciplines, it's also present. And I think we'd like to think, mm-hmm, that it's, less of a problem in the STEM disciplines, but then we keep hearing examples where, you know, computer scientists are told that they're not even allowed to ask questions about why, or that it's a closed question about why there are fewer women represented in CS, for example.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask, though, you know, there you're talking in your example, which is pretty telling, and I think we all, only the person with the hardest heart among us wouldn't say, man, that one person who stood up in a room of, 1,200 people and saying, yeah, I'm a conservative, that takes something, yeah. That takes some guts, and you feel bad for that person. But, you know, that's kind of political ideology. And does that actually affect the way in which you do scholarship or the kind of production of knowledge in terms of research? And I'm asking this partly because, again, my background's in literary studies, and everybody that I had as a professor at the graduate level was, I know that they voted. The big elections, I guess, I was involved in were 88 and 92, and everybody voted for Mike Dukakis and everybody voted for Bill Clinton. But when I talked to them about stuff, or when I talked to them about ideology and ideas, they were not at all uniform, and they all hated each other. I mean, some of them were like hyper-Marxist, others were postmodernists in a way that I kind of identified with, where they were celebrating, kind of the way the market proliferated identities and possibilities. So I guess, the succinct way of asking this is, do political affiliations really kind of contaminate the variety and quality of research being done?
And behind your question, and you hinted at it a little bit, is the idea that political ideology might just be the wrong label for it. But really, our inherent theories about how the world works and why things are the way they are, and what are the sort of best solutions to the world's problems, those are really broader ideologies that I think lead us to, at some point, for many of us, not all of us, to have a political identity and affiliation. So it really starts with, the ideas and the intuitions. And so then to the question of, so does that matter for research? And, I think it's common. I don't know that this is everybody believes this, but I believe we all have biases, right? And so
sure,
those biases in terms of ideology, for example, I have an example in my mind and I'll share it in a minute. Absolutely cover or inform or color the questions we even think to ask about the world around us. So if I'm, for instance, interested in the causes of poverty, and I'm very much oriented toward, a systems approach and systems of oppression and bias and whatnot, then I'm more likely to even think to ask questions about the way those systems are functioning to either create poverty or to keep people in poverty or to make it difficult to break out of poverty. In any research project, people start with a question, right? So if the bias informs the question initially, that would be over time, there would be this nudge toward influencing just one. Mm-hmm. If we all have the same bias within a discipline and who are working within the same set of problems, that would nudge the kinds of questions as a field we're thinking to ask. And then, you know, the way the Academy works is we have this reverence for peer-reviewed scholarship. And so say a scholar who has a bias that's different than what everybody else in the field has dares ask a question or uses a methodology or interprets a set of data in a way that's at odds with what those peer reviewers are going to be assuming or their bias, then that mm-hmm. scholar is going to have a harder time getting that piece of research, even if it's incredibly well done, published, and not because of the process, but because of the conclusion. And so then, you know, then that scholar is going to have, without publications, is going to have a harder time getting job interviews and a harder time getting a job and a harder mm-hmm. time getting tenure. And so in many ways, I think the Academy's kind of stacked the cards against itself in terms of.
So, I mean, so really the idea then is absolutely, you know, and I was thinking while you were talking about how, you know, a lot of times or in early primatology, many of the researchers were male and they tended to focus on the behavior of male primates without even thinking about it, partly because they're men. And then, you know, when later people started looking at the behavior of female monkeys and whatnot, and it's like, holy mm-hmm. shit, like a lot of our theories, it's not even that they're wrong, but they're so incomplete or they just aren't, you know, they're not taking into account as much as possible. I love the idea of intellectual diversity. In that, you know, in the Academy especially, because the idea is to produce new and better understandings of the world around you. And you do a pretty good job of making it seem like it's not just special pleading then, because, you know, to be intellectually diverse, I'm at a disadvantage, so give me a leg up. This is more of a discussion of how do we create a system that is more likely to ask and answer more different questions in a serious way.
And I would also add, I mean, the world faces so many incredibly challenging problems. So we already talked about, you know, mentioned poverty, but if we yep. think about, you know, the access of fresh food or food and fresh water, or there's so many things that we're facing. And if we're truly interested in solving those problems, I think we're crazy to just take, you know, to think that one ideological bin somehow miraculously has all the right solutions in it. And so I'm truly committed to wanting to fix the world and help the world, whatever that might mean. Mm. I feel like I owe it to that problem and to the people I'm trying to help to actually look with real, you know, real sincere curiosity and interest in the range of possible ideas and possible ways of thinking about the problem and then twisting it. And then and doing so with more than just kind of a passive, I've got that idea, I've got it, but they're already wrong.
Right.
They're really engaging with fluency and sincerity with the people who have those ideas, so we can actually use those tools to solve the problems.
So who could possibly be against this? I mean, you've painted, and I don't mean this sneeringly. I mean, it's you have painted an incredibly attractive picture of what intellectual work, you know, an intellectual work is going to be in many ways and should be centered at university settings, in the academy, in higher education. This is an immensely attractive scenario that you've painted. Who would be against heterodoxy in higher education?
I think that's a really good question. And that's one I'm honestly, you know, I'm working to better understand. I think there are certainly a lot of people, and not just students. I feel so often, you know, we start, by we, I mean people in general, talking about, you know, that somehow these mm-hmm. students, they just can't tolerate difference of ideas, and that, oh, these students are just, you know, they're encoding all sorts of difference as threat. But I think those of us who are in the academy, the professors and the administrators, mm-hmm. we're making some decisions too that I think, I don't know, I can't figure out quite the origins of the discontent. Mm-hmm. I'd be curious if you have some intuitions on this.
Well, I mean, one of the questions I was going to ask you, I guess, and this would be a good, maybe a good time for you to talk a little bit about your personal experience within the academy, because you were trained as a psychologist at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. You've worked at George Mason. You've worked at Harvey Mudd. So you not only have lived in different areas, and I believe you have an undergraduate degree from a small liberal arts college in Nebraska, you've lived everywhere in the country, you've been at different types of universities. What was your experience with, you know, with these issues that, you know, somehow end up with you being, you know, the executive director of Heterodox Academy?
Yeah, so it's such, I don't know, I find it an interesting story. We'll see if your listeners agree. So going to school, first of all, growing up in Nebraska, I went to a, you know, a public high school where there was never any assumption that I was going to college in the first place. So when, you know, at some point there was a high school counselor, Jean Church, I remember her name, she was amazing, who pulled me in and said, you know, you're a smart kid. I think you should go to college, but you've got to take this test. And so we took the ACT in Nebraska. And I scored really well. And so before you know it, there's all this junk mail coming to my house. And it literally went in the trash. It was junk mail. So like, there was never, you know, that was just a minor example of how in my household, there was never an assumption I was heading to college. My parents were not part of the college search process or visiting process or anything like that. And so by the time I get to Nebraska Wesleyan, I'm assuming that, you know, I'm not really supposed to be here, that I just kind of kept my mouth shut mostly in classes because I thought all these other kids, they really know what's going on. And my goodness, they're able to talk with such fluency about what's going on in the world. And I've been so sheltered. I don't know any of this. And I remember thinking like, okay, I just gotta understand the right way to think about things. And this was a long time ago before, you know, these sorts of problems kicked up. And then I remember it was actually in a women's studies class and just hearing all these different perspectives on, it was on, you know, gender expression and how we dress and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it blew my mind. And I realized like, oh my gosh, all these people have different perspectives. And I loved it. That was like my initial kind of awakening moment. But then, you know, fast forward to, you know, I go to graduate school and then I end up at Harvey Mudd, which is just, it's been absolutely my dream job. I've been there for 13 years. I'm a full professor, tenured in psychology. And my area of expertise is really in close relationships and applying close relationship theory to collaboration and in community building. And so that's kind of the mindset I've been approaching my classes and my campus service and whatnot with. And then it was over the past, I want to say 3 to 5 years, that it, like the classes just started feeling different. And I thought maybe, okay, maybe I'm just getting old in my career and I'm not bringing the same energy. But our discussions got pretty flat, frankly. And I tried, well, let's bring in some new readings. Let's, you know, mix up the formats a little bit and see if I can reinvigorate the energy. And I should say these students are brilliant. They, you know, the cream of the crop of the nation. So, you know, I know it's not their intellectual ability. You know, I know that no way is that a reason for why my classroom started to feel different. And then, you know, I started noticing all these comments, these comments happening with more frequency, things like, well, I understand that that's your perspective and that's fine. I see it maybe just a little bit differently, but there would be almost an apology for seeing it differently or not a willingness to turn to the other and be like, is it okay if we take up this object of inquiry and we twist it and we turn it and we move it around within the shared space of inquiry? And we really, by digging in together, that maybe we can get a deeper understanding of the nuance of this thing. It was more just like, no, you get to see the object from your perspective. I get to see it from my perspective. And that's that. And what we started to miss, or what I think we started to miss out on, is that back and forth of the idea that it's only because we see things differently that we can actually get some good thinking done together.
What are your suggestions? I mean, or what are your intuitions? First off, I mean, you talk about it as the students are bringing a very kind of closed off mindset to the classroom where they can recognize that they don't all agree, but they don't want to then have a conversation about, oh, well, you know, your perspective sounds interesting to me because of this, or you're wrong because of this. I mean, so it was for you, you felt it coming more from the students. What was going on at the faculty level? Did you also see among your peers, were people kind of walling themselves off from that kind of multiple, you know, engagement of a different viewpoint.
Yeah, and I should also say with the students really quick that I know for a fact they're having that more nitty gritty, let's get into it conversation back in the dorm rooms and whatnot. So it's not,
right.
Yeah, so
yes.
Like you said.
That's one of the hardest things, isn't it, for professors to admit. And, you know, you forget as a student, you know, your conversations with your professors were very different. And then when you're a professor, you think that they're, you know, the only thing that matters is the conversation they're having with you. But yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right to point
that
out.
Yeah, and so then the question is, well, what are the concerns? And one of the cool tools that we have at Heterodox Academy is the Campus Expression Survey. It's a free downloadable, anyone can use it, self-report instrument that you can give to, say, a class or an entire campus or the entering first-year students to figure out what sort of students, so who is afraid to speak up about which issues and why, so what do they think are the consequences. And we're doing our first, you know, nationally representative sample this week. Actually, we're collecting the data on it. But what we've noticed thus far in our non-random sampling of students is that they tend to most fear the censure of other students. So when they are able, or when they're at a point where they're in relationship with someone, say they're, you know, their dorm roommate or whatnot, that they can have the hard conversations because they don't fear that sort of social backlash that you would get in a classroom, even with 18 students, much less, you know, 100 students or whatnot. So just to say that I think, you know, in terms of what can we do about it in the classroom, you mentioned that quickly, and I'll just say I think helping all of us build more relationship and seeing each other as fellow imperfect humans is a great place to start. Now to your question about what's going on at the faculties, we're hearing a lot of examples of, you know, people on, say, search committees, job candidates, ideologies or political leanings coming up with comments like, well, I'm not sure they would be a good fit, or I wouldn't want to, there was one I heard where it was like, that person's advisor had this really extreme, I don't even remember what the view was, we wouldn't want in our department somebody who is trained by somebody like that.
Wow.
Like, so guilt by association, even though I don't think there's probably anything to be guilty about. But the ways that it comes up in little, you know, and it's the small comments, it's the little razor cuts that you start to notice. We heard about a faculty meeting where there was a colleague or there was somebody up speaking and they had served lunch at this faculty meeting. And in the lunch, you know, in the lunch bags were bags of potato chips. And so those are pretty loud. And people were eating the lunches that they had been given at the meeting. And a faculty member stood up to say, hey, this is a microaggression that we're making all of this noise while this person is talking. And, you know, so the same sort of dynamics that are playing out in the classrooms are also playing out, you know, among the faculties. And I don't think that's a coincidence at all. I think it's, we're part of the same loop.
Do you, how much of this do you think is conceivably part of the problem with university life now? And I think this affects students and it also affects faculty. You know, students, whether they're paying for it out of pocket or their parents or the taxpayer or whatever, you know, it just costs a lot more to go to school. And there's this sense increasingly that if you don't graduate from college, you know, you're finished or you're going to have a lower middle class or a downwardly mobile life. So people are nervous. They're upset. They show up and they're kind of, you know, on edge. And then at the faculty level, and this is true in many fields, if not all academic fields, there's a shift away from tenure lines, you know, adjunct teacher. The only adult jobs that are growing at universities are administrators and residence life counselors. And do you think part of this is a response to a kind of sense of low level or maybe high level economic anxiety all the way around?
You know, I haven't thought about it in those terms, and I find that, I want to think more about that. What I do know, and I'm thinking here as a relationships researcher, that we know that when anxieties are high, when the world feels more precarious, there's a lot more ambiguity out there, when threat seems high, we have, all of us, we have a tendency to turn turn to safety. We don't necessarily run, you know, very few of us just run right into the, like, we want more chaos in our lives and whatnot. And so it would make sense psychologically that amid economic uncertainty, and you know, I was telling someone the other day, I can't even have Alexa tell me the news when I have my 8-year-old in the house, because I have no idea what she's going to say. And it's the world feels uncertain right now, economically and otherwise. And so it makes sense that people would want to stay closer to what feels comfortable.
But that's also, isn't it kind of odd? And I know this is some of the work that Jonathan Haidt has done. He and Lenore Scanese published an article in Reason. I mean, we titled The Fragile Generation, about how we're treating children as if they've never been more at risk. But in most cases and in most ways, things really have never been better. Steven Pinker, in his new book, Enlightenment Now, you know, charts the massive and, you know, and it's not perfect, but it's nearly perfect increase in wealth and wealth, you know, and well-being and kind of acceptance, you know, by most indications, you know, things like, you know, people are less racist, less sexist, et cetera. So it seems kind of odd, doesn't it, that we seem to be more touchy and move, you know, and insisting on the safety of a kind of monolithic intellectual environment at colleges.
Yeah. And can I just give a shout out to Lenore's organization, letgrow.org. They,
absolutely.
Oh my gosh, I'm just so in love with what, as a parent and as someone who values, you know, robust, resilient children and childhoods, they are doing just amazing things and helping give children their childhoods back, and, you know, making sure that we're not too safe to succeed, as, you know, from a childhood to adulthood. So everyone should go check out letgrow.org. Sorry, I totally lost the real question that you had before. I was gotten so excited about Lenore.
One of the activities that Heterodox Academy does, besides having this website and building a community of scholars, and you said you have nearly 2,000 members who are faculty members and grad students and the like. You recently held a day-long conference in New York, and you know, one of the most generous things about that too is that videos of it are all up online at the Heterodox Academy website, so people can experience it. What were the goals of the conference, and do you think you achieved that?
That's a great question. Yeah, so the conference was on the 15th of June. It was in New York at the Time Center. And I'll be honest, when we first said, oh, we're going to have this conference, we should try this, it felt really important that we needed to move beyond the, oh, there's a problem, the sky is falling, to actually talking about solutions and what is it that different stakeholders, from the students, the professors, the trustees, administrators, what are the levers each of us could be pulling within our local context to affect change? And when we first decided to do this conference, I had no idea. I was like, maybe 50 people will want to come to this. We ended up filling the Time Center with 350 people. People came in, one guy came in from Germany just for the, you know, this 2-day experience, and then he bopped back, and we had international visitors and scholars and community leaders, and the point was to see if we could first define and diagnose the problems, figure out what challenges are actually being faced by the professors and administrators on their campuses and in their disciplines, and then see if we could figure out ways of creating positive change in the classroom and also on campuses. As you mentioned, we did it as panel discussions. So there were, gosh, I want to say 7 panels throughout the day. Each one was moderated by a journalist. So Scott Jasnick from Inside Higher Ed, and Barry Weiss from the New York Times. And we just had all these, you know, wonderful thinkers. So they moderated the panels, and the panels themselves were populated by, you know, again, just all sorts of really high profile, interesting people who are thinking about these issues in non-homogeneous ways. That was part of the beauty of this, is that we really worked to bring different viewpoints to the panel, to kind of walk the walk of viewpoint diversity. And it worked. It was just brilliant. If people can only watch, you know, one of our panels, I would check out the one called Big Questions and Heterodox Answers. It was, you know, an hour and 15 minutes with Alice Drager, Shadi Hamid, Angus Johnston, who studies student activism, John McWhorter, Jason Stanley, and Camille Foster. And just trying to, you know, they tackled questions about, you know, what is the relationship between viewpoint diversity and, you know, and inclusion and other sorts of diversity? What's the core purpose of higher education? And how does all of this relate to political discourse in the country beyond the academy, too?
How much do you think, perhaps, let's take for granted, and, you know, and I'm willing to, I think it's true that, you know, the academy definitely has become increasingly ideologically, first off, increasingly ideological over the past, say, 30 or 40 years, and in a particular direction. It's not just now, you know, everybody is ideological, and that, but, you know, there's 50 different ideologies. I mean, there seems to be, at least in the fields I know best, kind of humanities and to a degree the social sciences, an interest in kind of controlling the way students think, and that work is showing that regardless of what we think, that the West in particular, and America in general, is a kind of system of oppression, which is directing and kind of ripping off people and making things less fair, less possible. If we stipulate that's true, and you might disagree with that, that characterization, but is part of this a shift in that or different people or different generations or maybe different subgroups have different understandings of what the university is for, that the university, and I don't buy this, but I mean, it used to be that the university was there to preserve the best that was ever thought and said, and that, you know, it's a repository of knowledge that we could, you know, society could go back to when it was running out of ideas or it needed a kind of freshening up of things, or that it's the place where knowledge is produced, and sometimes in very instrumental ways. I mean, the whole rise of land grant colleges and agricultural and technical schools, technological schools after the Civil War, and the idea was, hey, you know, you're in Nebraska, you need really good, you need good farming ideas, and let's support them, and that's part of the university. And now there seems to be a fairly widespread idea that, you know, colleges are places of political indoctrination, so that we are creating not simply good citizens who are critical thinkers, but rather people who believe certain things, and they're going to leave the university and implement the world that the professors think is the best. Is it that we are grappling actually, I mean, we're looking at the ideological straitjacketing of the university, but it might, the root cause might be that different people have wildly different ideas of what the university is for, and we're not really debating those anymore.
Yeah, I mean, this, the impulse or the possibility that we're teaching students what to think instead of how to think is really, really scary, mm-hmm. because we might, let's imagine for a moment that somehow we actually have a complete handle on the current state of affairs and what the world needs right now. I guarantee we that same understanding is not going to be the full understanding in 5 years, 10 years, 100 years. And I feel like if we lose that ability to the how to think, like to know how to engage with different ideas, to twist and turn, whatever it is we're studying, gosh, I worry about the future a lot. So, but it's also the case, I don't think there's no way any one of us actually knows, you know, that we have the full right answer, that mm-hmm. somehow, you know, I always tell my students, like, really, what are the chances that here I am, you know, a 43-year-old woman who grew up in Nebraska and who now lives, I guess now I live in New York, but what are the chances that I was somehow the chosen one, that somehow I'm the one who was given the keys to all knowledge and to get it right and to not screw it up. And, you know, there's no way it was me. And so as soon as I have that moment of intellectual humility, then I need to become, you know, curious about how do other people see it, what's incomplete about my knowledge for the current context as well as for the future context. You know, and I'm thinking about the example you gave about, you know, the primate researchers historically being men, and then eventually they're female primatologists and they're asking different questions. And, you know, it's the same thing with, you know, when we want to, I think we absolutely should be talking to scholars and people and other people, not to say scholars aren't people, they are, but from all sorts of different nations and experiences and perspectives and walks of life. And that's the beauty of you know, all diversity in part is because it helps us create a more full understanding of knowledge. So if the university becomes just this place where, you know, the select people who happen to get those jobs get to tell the rest of us what to think, they don't have a lock on truth, on the total truth or whatnot. And if we're blocking out other people, I think we've got a big problem.
Are you optimistic that the kind of dialogue or the discussions, the conversations that you're starting at Heterodox Academy and whatnot, that these will, that maybe not win the day, but are you confident that there's a real appetite for that within faculty and students at today's colleges?
I am. And I'll tell you, the thing that gives me the most optimism and the most hope is, frankly, just the number of people who reach out to us, the students who on my own campus would show up for closed-door conversations to say, hey, something felt really weird about that, and that people are starting to notice. And now I'm getting, this role as the executive director, I'm getting students from all over the place emailing me saying, there's this weird thing going on my campus. I wasn't sure what to make of it, but based on what I'm hearing there, it's starting to make sense. And the number of professors who are saying that, a lot of them are also saying, I'm not yet at a point where I'm willing to stand up and say this publicly on my own campus, but I suspect, frankly, that next year, the academic 18-19 year, I think it's going to be a tipping point where just people are going to be, you know, we're done scratching our heads. Now I'm going to say out loud, this isn't making sense. We're doing some damage here. We need to find another way.
Well, we will leave it there. Thank you. That's a hopeful note, assuming that we make it to the next academic year. I want to thank Deborah Mashick. She's the executive director of Heterodox Academy for speaking with Reason. Thank you, Deb.
It was a delight. Thank you for having me, Nick.
This has been the Reason Podcast, and I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes or at Google Play or wherever, and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks so much for listening.